All right, picture this. You're all set for that epic elk hunt in Montana. Got your gear, dates are locked in. You can practically smell those pine needles.
Sounds idyllic.
But then, bam, the non-resident hunting license is 25 times more than what Montanans pay.
Ouch.
Yeah, big ouch. And that's precisely what happened to Lester Baldwin and his case, Baldwin v. Fish and Game Commission. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it brought up some serious questions about state power versus individual rights.
It really gets at this fundamental tension in our legal system, you know? Can states actually favor their own residents when we talk about resources, or does that completely go against the Constitution's promise of, you know, treating all citizens equally?
Okay, so we've got a mountain of legal briefs here, case summaries, even pieces of the justices' opinions. So walk me through this. Just how big was this fee difference?
Oh, we're not talking about a couple of dollars here.
Okay.
In 1976, when all this was going down, Montana residents, they paid a measly $9 for an elk tag.
$9?
$9. Non-residents, they had to fork over $2.25.
Wow, that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, and hold on, it gets even worse. They couldn't even just buy a simple license for elk. They were forced into this combo license that just pushed the price even higher.
So this wasn't just some symbolic fee. It was like a real roadblock for out-of-state hunters.
Exactly, a real barrier to entry. And that's where our spantiff, Lester Baldwin, enters the scene. Now, here's the twist. He was actually a Montana resident.
Interesting.
But he was a hunting guide. So these crazy non-resident fees, they hit him right where it hurt, his livelihood.
Yeah, fewer clients, less business for him.
Exactly.
Okay, that adds another layer to this. So how did a case about, you know, elk hunting in Montana end up at the Supreme Court?
Well, because it hit on this core constitutional issue, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, this clause basically says states can't discriminate against citizens from other states.
Okay, so straightforward enough.
Right, but the court has always wrestled with where to draw the line. Does this protection, does it extend to things like recreational hunting licenses? Or can states say, hey, this is our thing, our residents come first?
So big stakes here. What were the major arguments on both sides?
So the majority opinion penned by Justice Blackmun, he kind of drew this line between fundamental rights and recreational activities. He said, voting, access to courts, those are essential for the nation, can't be restricted based on where you live.
Makes sense.
But elk hunting, that's just for fun, not a fundamental right, so states have more wiggle room to make their own rules.
So basically, Montana, charge whatever you want for non-resident elk tags.
Yeah, pretty much. They said elk hunting, you know, it's not essential for national unity, and Montana has a legitimate interest in managing its wildlife and making sure its residents can enjoy it.
Okay, but what about fairness? Like, isn't that unfair to folks from other states?
That's where the dissent comes in, hot and fiery, written by Justice Brennan. He argued the Privileges and Immunities Clause, it requires states to do more than just say, you're not from here, tough luck, to justify this kind of discrimination.
So he wasn't convinced?
Not at all. He found Montana's arguments about, you know, the fees covering conservation or making sure non-residents chip in, he found them pretty weak, honestly. Speculative, lacking evidence.
So we have this clash. States' rights to manage their resources, but also individuals' rights to be treated equally. How did the court try to balance these interests?
They also brought in the Equal Protection Clause, another constitutional safeguard against discrimination.
Right.
But here, they used what's called the rational basis test. It's a pretty low bar for the state to clear. Basically, they just have to show some logical link between what they're doing and a legitimate goal.
And Montana said those higher fees, they were about conservation, and that non-residents weren't paying the state taxes that support wildlife.
Right, and the court basically bought those arguments. They leaned on this idea of states acting as a trustee for their wildlife, like the residents are the primary beneficiaries.
So Montana's elk belong to Montana's people kind of thing.
Exactly, and they get to decide how to share them with outsiders. It sounds a bit like a club, doesn't it?
It does a bit. So it sounds like the court was giving states a lot of power over their resources. But were there any limits, any pushback on this whole trustee thing?
Oh, yeah. Even Chief Justice Berger, who actually agreed with the outcome, he had some reservations. He said, hold on, don't take this trustee logic too far, especially with private businesses.
Okay, yeah. Like, what if Montana started charging outrageous prices for skiing or park entry just because you weren't a resident?
Right. Chaos. It could get really messy. Exactly. And Brennan, in his dissent, was really insightful here. He didn't just disagree. He gave us a roadmap for future challenges to these kinds of discriminatory fees. He said, look, states, you need solid evidence, not just legal theory, to justify charging non-residents so much more.
So a higher standard of proof.
Exactly.
Okay, it sounds like this case, while it sided with Montana, it also created some boundaries, some ammo for future challenges. But let's be real, what does all this mean for someone actually planning that elk hunt in Montana? Are they just out of luck?
Well, they'll probably be paying a lot more than their Montana buddies. The case basically said states have significant power here, even if it means favoring their residents.
Okay, so some power to the states, but with limitations.
Exactly, and here's where it gets interesting. This case might be from 1978, but the questions it raises, they're more relevant than ever. Climate migration, competition for resources, the whole debate about individual rights versus state power. What even is a truly fundamental privilege in this day and age? Could states apply this logic to things like water rights, disaster relief?
Wow, okay, now my brain is doing backflips. We're just scratching the surface of this case, and it already feels like a Pandora's box of constitutional questions.
Oh, it absolutely is. And Brennan, with that fiery dissent of his, he threw down the gauntlet. He really did, challenging future courts to grapple with these complexities.
And this is why we deep dive, folks. This case might be about elk, but it's really about so much more.
You know, it's fascinating when you think about how the Baldwin case might be viewed today, right? Like, given all the concerns about climate migration and resources becoming more and more scarce, we're seeing more and more people having to move because of climate change, right? Forced to relocate to areas that have more resources, more, you know.
Right.
Could we see these, you know, resident first arguments coming back?
Yeah.
When we talk about things like water rights or access to land, you know, for farming.
That's a really good point. We've kind of seen this already happening in places like California, right?
Yeah.
Where water rights are already this huge issue, especially during droughts.
Oh, absolutely.
So could Baldwin be used to say, well, newcomers, even if they're climate refugees, they can't have as much access to water?
It's definitely a possibility. And it brings up these really tricky legal and ethical questions, you know?
Yeah.
On one hand, states, they have to protect their own residents, right? Make sure they have what they need. But then we also have this moral obligation to help people in need no matter where they're from.
Yeah.
So how do you balance that, especially when everything's getting more scarce?
Like, we're on this collision course, you know? You have these legal precedents like Baldwin.
Right.
And then you have the reality of a changing climate and people on the move.
Yeah.
What happens when the law clashes with our sense of fairness, our sense of compassion?
That's where things get really interesting legally, and where, you know, lawyers have the crucial role. We have to be creative. How do we take the existing legal framework and make it work for these new problems? Maybe it means going back to that state trusteeship idea, asking if it still makes sense in a world where, you know, resources are all connected and people are constantly moving. Or maybe we need completely new legal tools to address, you know, the specific needs of climate migrants, make sure they have access to the essentials.
So Baldwin, even though it's about these elk hunting licenses,
right,
it gives us a way to look at these much bigger societal problems.
Exactly. It makes us think about, you know, what does it mean to be a citizen? What does it mean to belong, to be a part of a community? Can states or even smaller communities legally and ethically say, our residents come first when it comes to these essential resources?
Right.
And if they can, where's the line? Which resources are so fundamental that you can't discriminate?
Yeah, it's like we're redrawing the boundaries of community in real time, trying to figure out who's in and who's out, and what do we owe each other in a world where, you know, where you're from isn't so clear anymore.
Absolutely. And cases like Baldwin, they can either reinforce those boundaries or help us find ways to bridge the gaps. They can be used to justify keeping people out or to promote more inclusion, you know, sharing responsibility for what we have. It really depends on how we interpret and apply them.
So for our listeners out there who are thinking, okay, interesting case, but how does this affect me personally?
Yeah.
What are some real-world implications of Baldwin?
Yeah.
Not just for elk hunters, but for everybody.
Well, I think on a very practical level, Baldwin really emphasizes how important it is to understand residency requirements.
Right.
For anything that might be tied to state resources, you know, professional licenses, in-state tuition, access to public lands, all that.
So do your homework.
Yeah, exactly. Before you move or do anything that might have those residency restrictions. But I think beyond that, Baldwin has these broader implications for how we think about allocating resources, right? In this world where we're all so interconnected and facing these common challenges, whether it's water rights in, you know, the dry parts of the West, or access to healthcare in rural communities, or how we distribute aid after a disaster, those principles in Baldwin, they're still relevant.
It's like a reminder that these legal cases, even ones that seem really specific,
right,
they can have these huge ripple effects. They shape how we allocate things, how we define community, and how we tackle some of the biggest challenges we face.
Couldn't agree more. It's about making those connections, understanding how legal decisions echo through different areas of law, and how they shape our society.
Okay, so we've talked about the big picture, but let's zoom back in on the legal nitty-gritty of Baldwin. We mentioned the Privileges and Immunities Clause and the Equal Protection Clause.
Right.
Can you give our listeners, like, the Law School for Dummies version of those?
Okay, sure. So imagine the Privileges and Immunities Clause, like this VIP pass for U.S. citizens.
Okay.
It generally means you should get the same treatment in any state, but like any exclusive club, there are exceptions. In Baldwin, the majority said elk hunting, it's recreational, so it's not covered by this VIP pass.
So Montana could treat out-of-state hunters differently, and it wouldn't violate their rights. But the dissent, they weren't buying that, were they?
Not at all. Justice Brennan said it's not about whether elk hunting is this fundamental right or not.
Right.
It's about whether Montana had a good enough reason to discriminate. Think of it like baking a cake. The state needs the right ingredients and a good recipe to get to their goal. If their justification is weak, like using salt instead of sugar, their argument crumbles.
I love that analogy. So Brennan was saying, look, I need more than just a vague excuse. Give me some hard evidence.
Precisely. And that's what makes his dissent so important, especially for, you know, legal scholars and lawyers. He was basically saying, states, if you're going to treat people differently based on where they're from, show me the data. Don't just rely on flimsy arguments or stereotypes.
Yeah.
You need proof.
A powerful argument, and one that resonates even more strongly now when everyone wants data, wants evidence.
Oh, absolutely. Now, the Equal Protection Clause basically says states can't deny anyone in their jurisdiction equal protection of the laws. But, and here's the catch, not every distinction between groups of people is unconstitutional. It's like a dress code. Some distinction, like saying you have to wear shoes in a restaurant, those are reasonable, right? But others, like banning people based on their hair color, that's not okay.
So it's about figuring out which lines are legit and which ones are discrimination.
Exactly, finding that balance. In Baldwin, they use what's called the rational basis test. So they asked, did Montana have a logical reason for charging different fees? And they accepted Montana's argument that the higher fees were about conservation and because non-residents don't pay state taxes for those programs.
But Justice Brennan, going back to your cake analogy, he said that reasoning was half-baked, right? He wasn't convinced.
Right. He thought they should be looking at it much more closely, demanding more proof to justify treating residents and non-residents differently. He laid out this roadmap for future challenges, basically saying, don't just tell me, show me. Prove to me that these distinctions are actually necessary to get to your goals.
So even though Montana won Baldwin, Brennan's dissent, it gave us this framework to challenge these kinds of laws later on.
Absolutely. It's a reminder that even when the court sides with the state, these dissenting opinions, they can have a real impact, you know? Influencing legal arguments, pushing for a closer look at state actions that might be stepping on people's rights, they plant these seeds for future challenges and can actually lead to significant changes in the law down the line.
It's like they're saying, hey, we might not have won this round, but the fight for equal treatment isn't over.
Exactly. And those seeds can sometimes grow into some pretty big legal victories.
It's fascinating, right? We're looking at this case about elk hunting, but it opens up these huge questions about a state power, about individual rights, about what it even means to be a citizen. It's like something as simple as a hunting license becomes this battleground for who belongs and who gets to benefit in our society.
It really shows how powerful the law can be when it tackles these complex social issues, right?
Yeah.
It shapes how we live together as a nation, and it reminds us that even these seemingly boring legal disputes can reveal these deep tensions and force us to ask, who are we and what do we value?
And for our listeners out there, lawyers, law students, Baldwin is a perfect example of how these seemingly small legal questions can have huge consequences. It shows that the law isn't just some abstract set of rules.
Yeah.
It's this living, breathing force that affects our lives in so many ways.
I couldn't agree more. And it highlights how crucial lawyers are in shaping those debates, advocating for their clients, and making sure that the law changes and adapts to meet the challenges of our times.
Very well said. This has been a really eye-opening discussion. But before we wrap up this episode, there's one more piece of the Baldwin puzzle I want to explore. It's a concept that might seem a little obscure.
Okay.
But it's really important for understanding the arguments in this case.
I'm listening.
It's the idea of the state being like a trustee for its wildlife.
Ah, the trustee concept. That's interesting. And it's been debated for centuries.
Tell me more. For our listeners, what does that mean? For a state to be a trustee for its wildlife? And how does this play into Baldwin?
Okay, so the basic idea is that wildlife, unlike, you know, private property, it's held in trust by the state for the benefit of its citizens.
Okay.
Like the state is managing these resources for the people, right? Making sure they're used sustainably and that the benefits are shared fairly.
Right, right.
This idea comes from way back, English common law, where the king was considered the owner of all wild animals. But in America, that ownership or trusteeship, it rests with the state.
So it's not just owning it. It's about responsibility. The state has to manage these resources wisely and make sure the public benefits.
Exactly. And this idea of state trusteeship was a big deal in Baldwin. The majority opinion, when they upheld Montana's higher fees for non-resident hunters, they leaned on this idea. They said that states, as trustees for their wildlife, have this special duty to make sure those resources are managed well, you know, sustainably, and that their own people benefit from them.
So it justified treating residents and non-residents differently. When it came to wildlife, it's like saying Montana has a duty to put its own residents first when it comes to managing those elk.
Exactly. The court basically said, look, states are acting as trustees for their wildlife, so they have more freedom to prioritize their own people when they're deciding who gets access to those resources.
Makes sense. But like everything in law, I'm guessing there are nuances, counterarguments to this trustee concept.
Of course, there always are. Justice Brennan, in his dissent, he didn't like this whole idea of state trusteeship.
Really?
He said it's this outdated concept that doesn't fit with how we manage wildlife today. He pointed out that wildlife, it often moves across state lines, so how can one state claim to own or control it?
Yeah, good point.
And he said this concept shouldn't be a free pass for discriminatory policies.
Right.
Especially when those policies end up hurting certain groups of people more than others.
So he was saying this whole idea of state ownership of wildlife is kind of a legal fiction, a leftover from a time when things were simpler.
That's a great way to put it. He was basically challenging the entire foundation of the majority's argument. He wanted a more sophisticated, a more modern understanding of how we manage wildlife and how we think about the rights of individuals to access those resources, no matter where they live.
So even though this concept of state trusteeship seems pretty straightforward, it's actually really complex, open to different interpretations. And it's probably going to keep being debated as resources get more and more strained and as we worry more about climate change and sustainability.
Absolutely. It's one of those legal ideas that can be used to back up all sorts of arguments,
yeah,
depending on your perspective. It can be a tool for conservation, for managing resources responsibly.
Right.
But it can also be used to keep people out, to limit access to what we need. It all comes down to how we interpret and apply it.
It reminds us that these legal concepts, even the ones that seem simple, they're often rooted in history and can be interpreted in different ways.
Exactly. And as lawyers, it's our job to understand all that, to wrestle with those different interpretations and fight for outcomes that are fair, that are just, and that are in line with the values we believe in.
Well, this deep dive into the trustee concept has really added a whole new layer to the Baldwin case.
Right.
It's amazing how this one idea can have such a big impact on how we manage resources, define communities, and balance the rights of individuals with the interests of the state.
It really shows how powerful legal concepts can be. They shape how we see the world around us, how we interact with it.
Right.
And it reminds us that those concepts are always evolving. They're challenged, they're reinterpreted, they're applied to new situations.
It's like a legal game of Jenga, right?
Yeah.
You pull out one block and the whole thing starts to wobble. You have to be really careful how you handle these concepts, understanding their history, their nuances, what they could lead to.
Absolutely. It's a game where you need both knowledge and wisdom. You need to know the rules, but you also need to know how to use those rules to get to a just and fair outcome.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground in this episode, haven't we? We dug into the Baldwin case, looked at all the legal arguments, thought about what it means for how we share resources, how we see individual rights, and even what it means to be a citizen. We unpacked this whole complex idea of state trusteeship.
It's been a great conversation, really insightful.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave our audience with a few questions to think about.
Okay.
As they consider the implications of Baldwin and other cases that deal with these same issues.
I'm all ears.
So first, with all this climate migration, with resources becoming more scarce, how do we reconcile the right of states to manage what they have with this moral duty to help people who need help no matter where they come from? How do we balance local needs with global responsibilities?
Such a crucial question, and it's only going to get more important in the years to come.
Absolutely. Second, in a world where everything is so interconnected, how do we make sure that legal frameworks, like this idea of state trusteeship, are updated so they reflect these realities and promote fair access to those resources?
Right.
How do we move past these old ideas of ownership and control and find a more collaborative, sustainable way to manage what we have?
That's another key question that requires careful thought and some creative legal solutions.
And lastly, as we've seen with Baldwin, what happens in one area of law can have ripple effects everywhere else.
Absolutely.
So as legal professionals, how do we make sure we're using those precedents, those past decisions, in ways that promote justice, fairness, and the well-being of both people and the planet? How do we make sure the law is a tool for progress, not a roadblock?
Those are all incredibly important questions, and I hope our listeners will keep thinking about them long after this episode is over.
Well said. And with that, we'll wrap up this part of our deep dive into Baldwin v. Fish and Game Commission.
You know, as we've been going through Baldwin and, you know, picking it apart, it really hits me that this resident versus non-resident thing, it's not just a legal issue, right? It's tapping into some deeper stuff like social and ethical currents. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about fairness, equity, the whole idea of community. If states can say, hey, our residents come first when it comes to things like hunting licenses or fishing permits, doesn't that create this system where anyone from outside is always going to be in a disadvantage?
Exactly. And in a world where people are moving around more than ever, you know, across state lines for work, for family, or just for a change of scenery, this us versus them mentality can really cause division. It can make people feel like they're constantly being punished for not being from a certain place, even if they're contributing to the local economy and the community.
It's a tough balancing act, isn't it? I mean, it makes sense for states to want to protect their own residents to make sure they have access to local resources. But at the same time, we don't want to create a system that feels like this constant battle between newcomers and people who have been there longer.
It's a real dilemma, and it's probably going to get even trickier as we deal with climate change, resource scarcity, and more migration. As these traditional boundaries start to blur and people are moving more freely, how do we even define community in a way that's inclusive and sustainable?
These are big questions, and it feels like Baldwin raises more questions than it answers. It's like we're rewriting the rules of society in real time, trying to figure out who belongs, who benefits, and how we share resources in a world that's changing faster than we can think.
That's a perfect way to put it. And the law, with all its precedents and changing interpretations, is at the center of this whole renegotiation. Cases like Baldwin make us examine these fundamental pieces of our society, citizenship, belonging, access, and ask, are these still relevant in the 21st century?
Okay, so as we wrap up our deep dive into Baldwin v. Fish and Game Commission, what are some key takeaways for our listeners, especially those in the legal field? What should they be watching as these issues keep developing?
Well, first, Baldwin reminds us that even these seemingly small legal cases can bring up really deep questions about basic rights, state power, and what it means to be a citizen. They can be like mini versions of much bigger societal debates.
It's a reminder that the law isn't just about rules and old decisions, but about how those things affect people's lives, their sense of belonging, their ability to get what they need, and their chances to succeed.
Exactly. Second, Baldwin shows us how much power these legal precedents have. Decisions made years ago can still influence how we approach things like protecting the environment, providing healthcare, or even immigration policy today.
It's all about connecting the dots, realizing that these legal issues are almost never isolated. They're tied to social, economic, and political forces. And understanding those connections is crucial for anyone working in law.
Absolutely. And finally, Baldwin highlights the importance of critical thinking, questioning assumptions, and being willing to challenge the way things have always been done. Remember Justice Brennan's strong dissent. Even though he didn't win the case, his arguments have had a lasting impact, influencing legal thinking and shaping future challenges to discriminatory policies.
It shows the power of dissenting, of standing up to those in power, and of using legal arguments to push for a more just and fair world, even when the odds are against you. Brennan's dissent was like planting a seed, and those seeds can grow into real change over time.
Absolutely. And that's what's so great about the law, right? It's always evolving, being challenged, reinterpreted, and reshaped to meet the changing needs and values of society.
Well said. This deep dive into Baldwin v. Fish and Game Commission has been an incredible journey. It might seem like a case from a different time, but the things it raises are more relevant than ever as we face a world that's increasingly complex, interconnected, and, let's be honest, uncertain.
It's a case that's going to keep people talking and influence legal arguments for years to come. And for those of us in the legal profession, it's a powerful reminder that our work isn't just about winning cases. It's about creating a future where everyone has the chance to thrive, no matter where they come from or what they call home.
That's a fantastic point. Thank you to our listeners for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you found it insightful, thought-provoking, and maybe even a little bit inspiring. Keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll catch you next time for another exciting exploration of a landmark case that continues to shape the world we live in.